All right, let's start off with prayer. Father God, as always, thank you so much for this opportunity to gather together and to study your word. I pray that you would give us wisdom, understanding, clarity of thought, Lord, as we go through these issues. I pray you'd help us to be biblical, Lord God, and help us to see into our own arguments and our own hearts as we discuss this topic, Lord. Help us to be critical of ourselves if we hold to a view that is sub-biblical, Lord, or does not do glory or honor to you. And I pray that you would continue to fill this time, Lord, with your presence so that we might be further blessed by your Spirit. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, lesson 15, Genesis through Joshua. We've been talking about all sorts of stuff. And last time we just got into biblical interpretations and discussing the various issues around that. Before we jump right back into that, I'd like to just do a little bit of review. Last time we talked about intelligent design. Can anyone tell me in brief what intelligent design is? What is intelligent design? Exactly. Natural order contains the complexity that requires an intelligent designer. Okay? So, intelligent design, we talked about, is focused on a lot of different stuff, but one of the main things that intelligent design, the movement as a whole, is focused upon is that when you look at the complexity out there in nature, it requires an intelligent designer. And the movement of intelligent design thinks that they can prove in some way, shape, or form that a designer is necessary for the state of complexity that the world finds itself in. Last time we talked about a topic called irreducible complexity, right? Irreducible complexity. The idea is that you can't just take... In Darwin's time, when he formulated the theory of evolution, the general thought was that the most basic level of an organism is fairly simple. Right? A cell, for example. You go down to a cell, and at the cellular level, you got basically a bag of jelly, a tiny little bag of jelly, right? And that you're made up of all of these cells. Well, we know now, due to advances in microbiology and things like that, that cellular processes are way more complex than that. Way, way more complex than that. And in fact, as we go through and we look at how science has evolved and progressed over time and how science has started to look at these issues, more and more it's becoming increasingly more difficult to believe in Darwin's theory of evolution without some sort of designer in the place because of just how ridiculous some of the things such as cells or natural processes, etc., just how complex they are really necessitates a designer in a sense. And so that's what the intelligent design movement is all about. It's focused on that. Good. Another question. Theistic evolution. This is something we talked about a lot. Can anyone tell me the theistic evolution? There are many different varieties, right? But we pointed out that there are two kind of main ones that we're concerned with, right? There's pantheistic evolution and panentheistic evolution, all that stuff. But we're primarily concerned with one or two varieties because they're the closest to Christianity. Can anyone remember what those were called? No, the day-age theory is a particular way of interpreting Genesis chapter 1, and we're going to get into that primarily tonight. Exactly. Minimal theistic evolution and maximal theistic evolution. Can anyone remember for me? They are basically defining how many supernatural acts God did before he set the natural world in its process, right? Can anyone remember the two supernatural acts of minimal theistic evolution? Okay. I'll just give you the answer here. Because these are hard. So, creation of first life, right? And Minimal theistic evolution, exactly, says that creation of first life, that is, naturalistic evolutionists don't have a problem, don't see a problem from non-life to life, right? It's a good question to ask them to see how that happens, because we don't witness it anywhere nowadays, right? But how does something go from being non-living, inorganic material to organic living matter, right? What in the world can affect such a process, right? Exactly. There have been, you know, attempts to recreate such a thing down through history as well in science, and they all end up failing, right? So creation of first life is a very difficult hurdle. Naturalistic materialists have no problem jumping over that hurdle. They just say it happened, right? But those who are in the theistic evolution camp like to say God did it, right? They think that hurdle's too big to jump over, so they say God did that part, right? There's another part of evolution that is difficult to grapple with that minimal theistic evolutionists attribute to God. What's that other step? Exactly. Creation ex nihilo, right? And that's creation of everything out of nothing, okay? So another big step, if you think about it, they talk about a Big Bang, right? What was there before a Big Bang? Well, we don't know. How did all of these stuff go bang, right? Well, we don't know. And so there's a lot of questions about where does matter even come from, right? Where does material existence actually come from? What existed before there was no matter, etc.? And evolutionists just continually say, we don't know, we don't know, we don't know, right? Well, theistic evolutionists say God did that too. Minimal theistic evolution basically says God created all matter out of nothing, and then he created first life. And then from there, the natural processes he put into place took care of the rest, right? So that's minimal theistic evolution. Maximal theistic evolution throws one more supernatural act in there. The creation of the human soul, right? That is, they differentiate between just the fact that there is life in something. A lizard is alive, right? But does it have a human soul? No, it doesn't. And we inherently distinguish between, especially those of us who are Christians or in Christian-like camps, we inherently distinguish between animals and humans. There's a difference there, right? And we recognize that fundamental difference. Now, naturalistic evolutionists do away with those differences, right? And they basically say that we're no different from animals, right? We're just highly evolved animals. But theistic evolutionists in the maximal camp aren't willing to concede that point. In the minimal camp, they are, right? They would affirm the exact same thing. The minimal theistic evolutionists would affirm the exact same thing, that man is no different than the animals in terms of his origin. But the maximal theistic evolutionist isn't willing to concede that point, and so he affirms the creation of the human soul as well as a necessary supernatural act of God. But then after that, it's all natural processes, right? I think they would say, I don't know for sure, but I would think they would say, most professing Christians that I know of try to fall in the maximal theistic evolution camp, okay? Those who would stick with the minimal theistic evolution camp, I think they would say that we have evolved a consciousness of sorts, right? That other animals haven't evolved yet, and or they might even go so far as to say other animals have evolved that consciousness, for example, but they are not able to speak like we are, or things like that, so they can't communicate it, right? I have heard some people argue before that, for example, the things that we generally attribute to human personhood, for example, like morality, they'll attribute to an animal as well, like a dog, right? And they'll say something like, well, a dog, for example, knows when it's done wrong. Well, typically only because of your reaction provoking that, right? But they'll say that even an animal is able to mourn, for example. If you've heard of people saying, like, for example, a couple that has a pet and one of the spouses passes away, right? Oftentimes the other spouse will say something like, they miss so-and-so, right? They sit and wait at the door every day for so-and-so to come home from work, and they never do. Things like that, right? Again, is that a learned response? Do they literally have a soul in the same way that humans do? This is all gets very tricky, right? And even in Christian camps, you run into an issue where you wonder, your beloved pet, am I going to see my beloved pet again in heaven, right? And that's a question that often gets asked, right? How do you answer that? That's a difficult issue, right? But regardless of where you fall on that particular issue, the fundamental fact of the matter is the Bible declares that there's a very real sense in which man is different from the animals. And the way the Bible describes it is when God breathes into man his life, right? And he becomes a soul or a living being, right? God doesn't create any of the animals in that same way. He does it to Adam in particular and uniquely, right? And so that's something that we need to take into account, and that's the distinguishing mark that we make at this point, right? Those who would hesitate to say the difference between man and animals would probably fall more in that minimal theistic camp, whereas those who are still want to affirm that man is, in a sense, we would prefer them, we don't want them to take either, I would argue, but we would prefer them to take the maximal position because it affirms more the uniqueness of humanity as really the preeminent or king of God's creation, right? Good question. Yes?
I don't know where I heard this, seemed like I read it over the last few months. I don't know what it's scriptural. Anyway, man ascends heavenward and animals descend downward. Is that something you've heard?
I have not heard that before.
Animals descend downward.
I haven't heard that before. It sounds roughly... It sounds equivalent to kind of what we would affirm and the Bible would affirm. That makes sense to me. I would like to know the context of where that quote's coming from and things like that before I affirm it. But has anyone else heard that before? I haven't heard it before. And just so you know, I was criticized for giving a cliffhanger on one of my most recent sermons. So I won't leave any cliffhangers. On the issue of whether or not your pet will be in heaven... so that I won't be seen as overstepping this issue, I think there are good biblical grounds to believe that there will be animals in heaven. I don't know that we can affirm with 100% absolute authority that they will be your animals. Okay, that's all I can say. The Bible doesn't give any explicit grounds that they're going to be my, you know, I've got a little dog, Rory, I love her to death, right? Is Rory going to be in heaven with us? I don't know. The Bible doesn't give me any explicit reason to believe that she individually would be, but it does describe the new heavens and the new earth. You know, it's got those metaphors. The lamb will lay down with the lion, the child will play in the den with the vipers and the cobras. And I think there's a sense in which it'll be similar to going back. In some ways, it'll be very different from, and in some ways, it'll be similar to the Garden of Eden, right? And in that situation, there were animals, right? Again, there are some ways in which it'll be similar, and then some ways in which heaven will be very different from that as well. So, just so you know, that's kind of my position. I had to write a paper on it, and I dodged the issue in my first response, and then my professor asked me explicitly, if, you know, Mrs. Jones asked you if her cat would be in heaven, what would you say, right? And I basically said, I think there will be animals in heaven. I don't know that we have enough information to assert conclusively that your particular animal will be. Okay? And that's that. So, there you go. There's my stance on the issue. Very much a non-answer, but that's how I do things. So, all right, let's go on to tonight's lesson then. Last time... Yes? Yes? No, the deists would affirm that, right? They would affirm creation ex nihilo, just number one, but not two or three, right? So they would say that God was needed to create everything out of nothing. Again, I've said this many times, but most people are deists. And if they're not explicitly in their affirmation, they are so functionally in how they live their lives. They basically would affirm, they think it's silly, the idea that everything came from nothing, right? So they want to affirm a creator in the sense that creation ex nihilo, they believe God created everything. But then after he creates everything, he doesn't create first life. Evolution does that. And he doesn't infuse humanity with a soul. Evolution, you know, takes care of that too. It's the only thing the minimal theistic evolution affirms that the deist doesn't is that God also had to create first life. Okay? So the minimal theistic evolution would say the first bag of jelly that eventually evolved into human beings and birds and all that stuff, that first little bag of jelly, God had to do. Whereas the deist would say God didn't even have to do that. The soup, you know, the primordial soup made the bag of jelly that turned into all the animals, right? So that's the only difference between the two. Exactly. It's enough to not feel absurd in thinking that everything came from nothing, right? Because even most people fundamentally know that that's absurd, that that doesn't make any sense, right? So they know there has to be a God. In fact, ask any random person off the street, is there a God? And the vast majority will tell you, yes, there's a God, right? They know that it's absurd to believe that everything came from nothing. But after that, evolution has made it to where God doesn't need to be there. So they just accept evolutionary theory, and God just wanders off and doesn't care about humanity. That's really nice and convenient for how I want to live my life, because there's no God ruling over the world who wants me to do anything. I can pretty much remain a naturalist. These are really progressive steps. If you think about it, atheism or agnosticism at the lowest level, they don't even affirm number one, right? Then you get up to deism, right? They affirm that creation ex nihilo. Then you go to minimal theistic evolution. They also affirm first life. And then finally you get to maximal theistic evolution, right? So there's kind of a progression there.
Would a deist think that the creator of that first act is worthy of worship? Or
is rationalism
have taken over in their mind?
I would think that they would just say that that God doesn't care about being worshipped. He doesn't care. He created everything and left, right? You know, the many reasons that Christians worship God are for his many acts and events down through history, right? And they affirm he didn't do any of that stuff, so.
I think a lot of the deism we see in our culture today is simply hoping that this, that gives them something besides here.
Yes.
If there is a God, he's going to take me the way I am, and there will be something in heaven or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, on the other side.
Yeah.
So we want to hold on to that.
Yep. No, you're absolutely right. Deism really, it takes the absurdity out of believing everything came from nothing, so they can get rid of that absurdity, right? And then it also takes the absurdity out of what does life itself mean if there isn't something after life, right? So they can get rid of that, right? And yet it maintains pretty much atheism throughout the rest of their actual life on Earth, to the point where, yes, God created everything, and yes, when it's all over, there's going to be a heaven where I'm going to talk to anybody who is not even religious, right? And the vast majority will say they're in a better place now. If somebody close to them dies, I'm going to see them again. All of these different things, right? And it's like, what theology? Yeah. On what basis do you arrive at any sort of conclusion that you know with any certainty about the afterlife? And what is often their response? Oh, it's my faith. I believe it by faith. And sadly, modern-day Christendom allows them to do that because it pretty much uses the exact same argumentation.
Well,
right? Rather than giving a good answer for why we should believe the Bible is the Word of God or anything like that, ask anybody who professes to be a Christian nowadays why they believe in Jesus, or press them on the issue, and they just say, oh, well, that's just my faith, right? I was in many classes in a college where I was there. The professor would ask who believes in God, and the vast majority of us would raise our hand, right? But I would be the only one trying to defend anything, any semblance of a biblical worldview in the class, right? The only one. And all the other people would be very happy to allow their worldview to be savaged pretty much in class and just sit there and think, well, it's just my faith. It doesn't matter, right? They just compartmentalize, right? And you have your faith, I have my faith, right? And yet somehow they think that translates into reality, as though believing something hard enough somehow made it real. And that's just not how the universe works. We know it's not. And yet when it comes to the issues of religion, we affirm over and over that that's exactly how it works. Look at Oprah and her promotion of all roads lead to God, right? And however the Muslim seeks to find God out, might be different than how the Hindu seeks to find God out, might be different than the Christian seeks to find God out, but we all end up in the same place in the end, right? Again, that's the mentality nowadays. So, but you're right, deism feeds right into that idea where I can be comfortable thinking there's an afterlife. Why? Because after all, I believe in God. And I can be comfortable thinking that, well, God created everything too, but other than that, God doesn't matter to me at all, right? I live my life completely as though He didn't exist at all whatsoever. It's a real shame. This is something that just baffles me. Again, it comes from a Christian worldview, but why do you think you're going to spend your entire life not giving one iota about God at all? Living your life as though He didn't exist, and then somehow step into eternity and expect to spend the entire rest of eternity with Him in sweet communion? You know, singing Kumbaya, or that He's just going to accept you graciously? I don't understand, right? You lived your life as though God didn't matter to you, and then you think He's going to matter to you now all of a sudden in the afterlife? It doesn't make any sense. Those who are truly God's people are eager to see Him and seek Him now, right? And they will do so throughout the rest of their lives, and they will finish the race and run it strong, right? And then they will be accepted into glory for the hope that was set before them. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me, but people don't often think through their worldviews. They just do what they please. Exactly. How do you know any of that stuff, right? That's what blows my mind, right? You want to say all roads lead to heaven, right? How can you even establish if something is true or false? Like, on what basis do you establish or determine those things, right? If there is a God, how do you know that He is accepting of all of these things? How do you know that He doesn't hate some of them and like the other ones? How would you know any of that stuff, right? That very issue gets me with all of the New Age movements, right? They believe in Mother Earth and they pray to eagle spirits or whatever, right? All this wacky stuff. And it's like, I want to stop and ask them, how do you know anyone's listening? How do you know that it's even there?
Because they're
God. There you go, right?
Oh my God, they're really talking about themselves, probably.
Yeah. Truly, a lot of people believe in their God, right? And you're absolutely right. It's a God they fashion in their own image or after their own likeness, who likes all the things they like, hates all the things they hate, and will accept them joyfully, right? So it's really a sad delusion that people live in. Okay, moving on now. I want to go on tonight, and I want to discuss the day-age theory, okay? There are a lot of issues surrounding the day-age theory, but I want to get into them tonight and just kind of discuss. Hopefully we can get through the majority of the day-age theory tonight. So last time we talked about the day-age theory. It basically says that each day in Genesis 1, right? There was morning, there was evening, the second day. There was morning, there was evening, the third day, etc. Each day in Genesis 1 represents a long period of time. And they often associate this with the same period of time as the geologic time scale or as secular science would affirm it, right? They see the exact same order of events. There's a very real sense in which some of these guys believe that Genesis, in a sense, is prophetic, right? Of this is how everything is going to come into existence, right? The plants first, and then the animals will come, and they think that things evolved in that same fashion, in that same order as it's presented in Genesis, right? So that's what a lot of these guys affirm. Okay. Last time I talked about, and this is tied to the idea that the age of the earth is old, right? It basically affirms that the age of the earth is old and then tries to kind of tie it in with the book of Genesis. Okay? I affirmed last time that they had four kind of arguments for their position, right? First, radiometric dating methods. Radiometric dating methods, according to them, just pretty much prove unequivocally that the earth is old. And because of that fact, then we have to try and fit the Genesis account into that natural science that they've come to. Next is geology, right? The geologic scale of time and how different, you know, rock structures are from different time periods and they have different fossils in them, all that stuff, right? So they affirm that as well. Next, I told you guys this was, I think, the most difficult one for us to answer, and that's the speed of light and travel. How can you see stars that are millions of years away if the universe isn't millions of years old, right? Millions of light years away. How can you see something millions of light years away if the universe isn't millions of years old? It doesn't make sense that you'd be able to see those things. In reality, you would think that we could only see out, you know, however old the earth is, let's say 10,000 years old or whatever, we could only see things that are 10,000 light years away and that's it. We wouldn't be able to see anything else out there because the light from that object hasn't reached us yet. Okay, so that's that one. And then they affirmed that the appearance of age in creation is deceptive, right? So one argument from young earthers and intelligent designers, and again, intelligent design isn't necessarily young earth creationism. Keep that in mind. But young earthers will often say that God creates things that look old. So for example, he created Adam, right? Adam, he didn't create as a baby, he created him as a full-grown man, right? And young earthers often say in the same way he probably created trees that were full-grown trees, right? That if you cut them and counted their rings, they would look like they're thousands of years old or whatever, but he created them full-grown, you know, brand new. Go ahead. Right. Yeah, they're very much tied to the millions of years thing, and really they're trying to use this as an argument against young earthers, right? They're trying to say that those young earthers, their God is deceptive. Their God is trying to fool everybody, but our God isn't. He does things via evolution just as we think it would be done when we cut the tree in half or whatever. He does it that way, right? That's kind of their perspective. Good. So those are four things I wanted you to keep in mind. Arguments for the day-age theory. Okay? Four arguments there for the day-age theory. And you can kind of see what they think is important, right? What they think is important and worthy when it comes to this issue. Okay? So let's go into this a little bit more. And then I want to kind of deal with the pros and the cons of the theory, okay? Like I said, it supposedly correlates with the geologic timescale in an old Earth, right? They basically affirm that the age of the universe is old and all things have worked in the way that they do now. Basically, the clock started at zero, and geology, dating methods, etc., show the Earth is billions of years old, and the Earth, just kind of evolved over time pretty much exactly the same way that the evolutionists say that it happened, right? They basically affirm that that's the case. There are a couple different camps. First, we would call the progressive creationists. And this is all under the umbrella of day age, okay? So this is all day age stuff. So first are the progressive creationists, okay? A man that holds to progressive creationism, I don't know if you've heard of his name before, his name's Bradley Olson, okay? Fairly well-known progressive creationist, Bradley Olson. And the progressive creationism, again, they all view the days in Genesis 1 to be long periods of time, but how God works amongst those long periods of time are often debated amongst themselves, right? So the progressive creationists basically say that God works through the process up to a certain point, And then he intervenes miraculously in the process. Okay? So these guys believe that God works through a combination of the natural process of evolution, right? And miracles. So God does both, okay? So he'll let the process go on and on for a little bit, and then he might intervene and work miraculously to create, I don't know, a bird, right? This theory deals nicely with all the gaps in the geologic record, okay? Because we talk about where are the transitional forms. You know, there aren't any. You know, we always talk about where are the transitional forms. They recognize the lack of transitional forms, right? And a way to account for that is they say, okay, evolution is happening naturally, right? But then God might intervene supernaturally at some point. They're progressive creationists. God is creating over time, okay? He'll step in at a different point in time, maybe millions of years after his last creative act, and he'll perform a miracle, and he'll make a bird or something. Boom. Right? And then he lets the process of evolution carry on over and over and over, and then he jumps in and he makes mammals, right? And stuff like that. Okay, so that's progressive creationism. It's kind of a hybrid of evolution and creationism, right? It tries to kind of meld the two together, right? So in summary, God creates the major types of plants and animal life at various times in geologic history. Okay? He does it in a miraculous way. And then he works through the process of evolution, as is his customary way, to develop the variety of plants and animal life. Okay, so he jumps in, makes a plant, jumps back out, and then the natural process of evolution creates the great variety of plants. Then he jumps in, makes a bird, and natural evolution makes the variety of birds. Then he jumps in, you know, and this, again, might take millions of years, whatever, right? But that's how they believe it. Does that make sense? I mean, not that it makes sense to you and you believe it, but that, do you understand how they view it? Okay, so that's progressive creationists. There are long periods of time of development with sporadic periods of God intervening. They actually claim that they're not theistic evolutionists. Okay, claim they aren't theistic evolutionists. And you can kind of see where they're getting that from, right? When we looked at the different camps of theistic evolution, all of them are affirming at some point God, you know, doing a few acts of creation, and then everything is evolving from those few things that he did, right? Whereas these guys are saying that God jumps in and intervenes and creates in a supernatural way and then jumps back out. Remember, theistic evolution only has the one, the two, or the three supernatural acts of God, right? Whereas these guys have many supernatural acts of God, but it's just spread over a very long period of time. All of the day-age believers, including progressive creationists, believe that death and suffering has been going on for all of these millions of years, long before Adam and Eve. Okay, we'll get to it, but I think that is the biggest argument against the day-age theory. The single biggest argument. Because God is using evolution to create everything, right? Even if he comes and creates a bird, evolution then produces the many types of birds, right? And how does evolution produce those many types of birds? Mutations and random chance over long periods of time, all through death, right? Death is the driving force that keeps these things going forward. Death and mutations, right? And natural selection keeps these things going forward, right? And so the way they deal with death is they say it's been around a very long period of time.
So they reject the Bible in that.
We'll get to that. Okay, I want to get to that tonight. They wouldn't say so. But it certainly seems so to us. Okay, good. So those are the progressive creationists. Next is the Hugh Ross, Gleason Archer view. Okay, Hugh Ross. They're just names of dudes, okay? Who's heard of Hugh Ross, right? You've probably heard of him. He is one of the most well-known of those promoting the day-age theory during our day, right? And then Gleason Archer. He's kind of an older guy, and he's written a lot of stuff like he wrote a good book on dealing with difficulties in the Bible, and it goes through the entire Bible and talks about all the difficulties, you know, the alleged contradictions and things like that. Gleason Archer has a great book on that. But Hugh Ross and Gleason Archer kind of promoted the next view that I'm going to discuss here. So not the progressive creationist, but the Hugh Ross and Gleason Archer view, okay? So in this one, God is creating new species, okay, at different times to suit the changing environment, okay? So the way this one is different is the environment is naturally evolving all the time, okay? And what God is doing is he's creating new species at different times. He's repeatedly placing extinct species with new ones, right? So we're having entire species go extinct and the new ones being formed due to God's creation. Again, he's intervening supernaturally as well, okay? He's intervening supernaturally as well. However, after the sixth day, God no longer intervenes supernaturally to create new species, okay? So God is creating new species. Up until the sixth day. Then he's done, okay? Yes, up until the sixth day. However long that took. Then he stops creating new species. So, endangered species, extinct species, all while new species are coming to existence, etc. Okay? And they base this basically on a reading of the fossil record where new species occur suddenly without any natural mechanism. Okay? So there's a similarity here between them and the progressive creationists. You can see the similarity, right? But there's a sense in which the progressive creationists are saying that God jumps in and kind of jump starts a whole new thing, right? He creates birds where there were never birds before or whatever, right? In this view, God is creating new species in between, right? And then once the sixth day comes, he's done, right? He's completely done creating new species.
The species in this instance is the same as kinds?
I don't think so. I think they actually mean species in the scientific sense. I'm going to read you some Hugh Ross tonight, okay? And I want you to note how focused he is on science and scientific language, okay? I read a good biblical exegete, and you can tell how they're talking, how they're thinking, how they're speaking, right? You can tell that they're steeped in the Bible, right? You read somebody who's good at interpreting the scriptures. Hugh Ross, when I read him, he just strikes me as so overly scientific and in that sense, focused on those sorts of things, right? If I was reading Hugh Ross and somebody told me I was reading Bill Nye, I'd believe them, okay? To give a little example, okay? So, that is kind of the two main perspectives. Now, in addition to these arguments, I want to talk about some more pros, okay? So, radiometric dating, geology, the speed of light, and the fact that if God created everything older, it would be deceptive. Those are four arguments they use, right? I want to talk about some other pros to this theory, okay? Some other pros to this theory. All of this controversy centers around how to interpret the Hebrew word yom, okay? Yom, okay? It means day. And the question is, how is it to be interpreted, okay? One of the pros in favor for these guys is that not every time in the Bible that the Hebrew word yom is used does it necessarily refer to a literal 24-hour day. Okay? So, if anyone would like to, well, I can read it to you guys. Open up your Bibles to Isaiah 11. Isaiah 11, and we'll look at verses 10 through 11, okay? Isaiah 11, 10 through 11. It says, in that day, okay? This is the same Hebrew word, yom, okay? In that day, the root of Jesse, who shall stand as a signal for the peoples, of him shall the nations inquire, and his resting place shall be glorious. In that day, again, Yom, the Lord will extend his hand yet a second time to recover the remnant that remains of his people. From Assyria, from Egypt, from Pathros, from Cush, from Elam, from Shinar, from Harnath, and from the coastlands of the sea. Okay? How is the word Yom being used here? Does it mean a literal 24-hour day? Right, in that time, right, in that period of time, right, and it's really in an indefinite period of time. You don't really know how long. It's just saying in that day, whatever day we're referring to, it's a time period, right? You might use the same terminology when you referred to back in my day, right? In English, you might use that same kind of language. Back in my day, we did it this way. You don't mean one day. You mean maybe during the entire decade to which you're referring or something like that, right? And the Hebrew word is used the same way here. It's they're using yom, but it doesn't mean a literal 24-hour day. Yes. So it's not always a literal 24-hour day, and we've seen an example here in Isaiah 11, 10 through 11. Okay? So that's one argument in their favor. Okay? I didn't say it was a good argument, Mike. Calm down. I just said it's one argument. They often run to this argument. Okay? So they say, okay, Yom doesn't always mean a literal 24-hour day, so who's to say that in Genesis 1 it means a literal 24-hour day? Okay? We'll come to that. So that's kind of one of their first arguments. Okay, the next argument that they like to use is go to Genesis 2:5. Genesis 2:5. This is kind of how they believe that the term is being used here. Let's see. Did I tell you guys the right passage? Four. I meant four. Okay. These are the generations of the heaven and the earth when they were created in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. That's the sense in which they say that term day is being used all throughout Genesis 1, right? They say it's being used in that same sense, right? In the day, in the time period, in, you know, when God did this, right? God wasn't necessarily, according to them, establishing a chronological order in which he created this, then he created this, then he created this. Rather, he's just referring to a period of time in which he did these things. Okay, so that's the sense in which they say to take it. Something like Isaiah 11 or Genesis 2:4. Okay. And the other argument they go to is if you go to the seventh day, okay, go to the seventh day and look at the program that's used. Typically, let's go to the sixth day first, okay? And you can see how God typically uses, how the language is typically used to describe the creation, right? So let's go, verse 31 in chapter 1. And God saw everything that he made, and behold, it was very good, and there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Okay, that little structure, there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. There was evening, there was morning, the fifth day. Okay, that structure is used entirely throughout all 6 days of creation, but it's not used on the seventh day. Okay, that same structure isn't used on the seventh day. If you go down to chapter 2, verse 3, so God blessed the seventh day and made it holy because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. And then it just says and moves on, and these are the generations of the heavens and the earth, etc. So on the seventh day, you don't have that same formula, right? Seventh day lacks the same evening, morning, seventh day. So it lacks that same language. So their argument is, because it lacks that language, it's intended to be taken as a longer period of time. Okay? Again, does that make sense? Not that you believe it or agree with it, but does it make sense?
What would be the point? Because it's not creation day. I mean, what's their argument? It doesn't mean what they're talking about.
They're just saying that it's not, it's considered... They're pointing out that here the term day, because their entire argument hinges on the idea that the term day used in Genesis 1 isn't necessarily referring to a 24-hour period of time. That's their whole argument, right? So if they can cast doubt as to how the term day is being used in other places in the Bible, then they think that strengthens their perspective, right? So in the seventh day, they say, it lacks that evening and morning nomenclature, showing that it is obviously intended to be taken as a longer period of time. And they say, ergo, it's not that far of a leap to go back now into Genesis 1 and read into the term day longer periods of time. Okay, it's not how I do exegesis either, but that's their argument. Okay. Yes.
They're all in the seventh day.
Yes.
It allows for that.
In the same way, it weakens their argument because the other days are specifically...
Right. Because the other days do have that nomenclature, right? No, I get exactly what you're saying. Okay, let's move on to the next one. I want to get through all of their pros, the pros of their arguments. Okay, they also say that God's days aren't necessarily our days. Okay, so does anyone recall some scriptures like a day is as a thousand years or a thousand years are as a day? Right, that they say God's days aren't necessarily our days. Okay, so they've got the Yom argument, they've got the seventh day lacking the nomenclature, and then they say God's days aren't really our days. And you can also find a verse in Psalm that seems to indicate the idea that God's days aren't really our days. Okay? So they clutch onto that. Okay? Let me read to you straight from Hugh Ross. Remember I told you guys, if somebody didn't believe in evolution and they picked up the book of Genesis and they just read it, would they conclude an old earth? Would they conclude the day-age theory? Doesn't seem so to me. Ross claims that's exactly what happened to him. Listen to his language. He says, in my first reading of Genesis 1, I saw indications that the Genesis creation days were long time periods. Simple textual observations. The timing of Eve's creation, the lack of evening and morning for the seventh day, and the Genesis 2:4 usage of the word day in reference to the entire creation week convinced me. He says he just came completely new to the Bible and started reading it, and he could see right away that the text was seeming to indicate the fact that these were long periods of time. Right away, he thought that was the case, right? Again, I asked you guys, if anyone randomly came to the Bible and didn't have a preconceived notion of evolution in their mind, what would they conclude? Hugh Ross seems to think that they would conclude precisely what he's thought up in the day-age theory, right? Exactly, because he has presuppositions. And that's the whole point, right? He comes reading from a particular perspective, and it's lo and behold, he finds his thoughts already there in the text, okay? But just to summarize this perspective, okay? Remember I asked you three issues that are important when coming to talk about this, right? How do we read creation? How do we read the Bible? How do we read creation? And how old is the earth, right? Remember those three? In Hugh Ross's perspective, and in the day-age theory's perspective, general revelation and special revelation are equally valid and complementary, okay? According to them. General revelation, remember I asked you, does one take precedence over the other? Should one be interpreting the other, etc.? These guys believe that general revelation and special revelation are equally valid and complementary. Okay? So just keep that in mind. How do we read the Bible and how do we read creation? For these guys, they're equally valid and complementary. Okay? Here's some things that you have going on in their view. They basically say, because of this, sorry, before I move on, they think that the Bible will give a prediction and then science will verify it to be true. Okay, science will verify the Bible to be true. And that's something strong with Hugh Ross. In his writings, he talks about how the Bible repeatedly affirms truths, scientific truths, right? And we'd recognize that it does as well in some places. It's not a science textbook per se, but it does say true things about science when it speaks on that issue, right? Hugh Ross is big on that, and he says that science and the Bible will always affirm the exact same thing, and so if science establishes a certain paradigm or a certain truth, and they know that to be true, then it's going to be backed up in the Bible as we understand it, okay? So, in their theory, death occurred before sin, okay? Plant life is included in death. Carnivorous activity is not necessarily bad, okay? And they distinguish between natural death and death as a result of sin, okay? They distinguish, and this is a big way they deal with this death issue, they distinguish between natural death, death that's necessary for the evolutionary process, and death as a result of sin. Yes. But then, no, this is something characteristic of all of these positions. They downplay the death and sin. They have to, according to their view. But for us, those who are biblically based in all of our reading, death is always the enemy. Death is always unnatural, right? Even if somebody affirms, oh, death is just a natural thing. No. Death runs against the grain of our human nature, right? We know inherently that death is bad and wrong, and we feel grieve. We grieve when we are encountered with death, right? And when we come face to face with death, it grieves us because we know in the deepest fibers of our being that death is wrong and inherently bad, and this isn't how things should work, right? Death is the enemy according to the biblical worldview, but not for these guys. They distinguish between natural death, which is no big deal, and sin death, okay? And, you know, we often distinguish between death as separation from God, right? We even talk about, in this language, there's a sense in which death is separation from God, and there's a sense in which death is dying. They latch right onto that same kind of terminology, right? And seem to distinguish between the two here, okay? Now, real quick, I want to talk about, let's see, should we go into the problems with a theory, or should we save that for next time? Vote. Next time? I think this is a good stopping point. And so I want you guys to think about these things now, okay? I've given you a little hint at some of the issues, right? But I want you to think about these things. So you've seen some of the pros of their view, right? Some of their biblical argumentation they try to refer to, and then some of the scientific argumentation they try to refer to as well. So think about that stuff next time. Come with questions. And come with a critical mind and try to think of how you would deal with these things. How do you address these issues, right? You know, I said this might be a pro for their view. Mike said, well, no, it isn't. Well, then how? How do you show that that doesn't actually prove as much as they want it to, okay? So don't tell me now. I know you have answers now. Don't tell me now. We'll talk about it next time, okay?
This is homework.
It's all poppycock.
Yes.